Welcome to Teaching Writing. My name is Roger Graves. I'm the host of this program, and today we're going to interview the editors of a new book called The Rhetoric of Oil in the 21st Century, Government, Corporate, and Activist Discourses. It's edited by Heather Graves, professor at the University of Alberta, and David Beard, an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we could get started by talking about where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, after moving to Alberta, I became more and more aware of the discourse and the rhetoric surrounding oil extraction and the whole vocabulary that goes with it. And I started to study it, but I also started to collaborate with two people in organizational studies, Leanne Lefsrud and Nelson Phillips. And so we were doing some research on oil, the rhetoric of oil in organizational studies. So I really wanted to do a book about rhetoric for writing studies and rhetoric people.
And David, how did you get involved in this project?
One of my great professional joys is helping facilitate new kinds of conversations. And one of the ways I do that is by contributing through editorial work. I edit special sections of journals, special issues of journals. And when the opportunity came up to be part of this conversation, it seemed like a great opportunity.
What were some of those past conversations?
Co-edited issues of argumentation and advocacy, about argumentation theory, about public sphere theory. I've assembled a collection of the best writings out of a journal from the American Society for the History of Rhetoric. I've spent 4 years editing the International Journal of Listening and pulling together some special issues for that.
So this is interesting to me because the advocacy piece, this is a kind of advocacy.
Absolutely.
Or some parts of it are. So the rhetoric of oil, what does rhetoric mean in this title?
Well, that's a good question because a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about it. In the introduction, we tried to define what David and I think of when we talk about rhetoric. I'll read the way that we defined it there. Rhetoric is public debate. That is debate about humanity's appropriate course of action on a complex, contentious issue with an uncertain outcome. Rhetoric is our only means to discuss such topics to achieve even partial agreement on how to proceed. Whatever stance participants take, they engage in rhetoric to present their perspective.
What is particularly significant, though, about this collection is that it brings together multiple disciplinary perspectives, right? There's no one definition of rhetoric that drives every essay. Instead, we have contributors from different national traditions and different disciplines coming to understand the discourse of oil. One of the things that's most significant to me as we're looking at these public relations and advertising discourses is that this isn't like a lot of other criticism of the mass media, where we're criticizing advertisements that result in people buying a car or buying a new pair of jeans. The discourses of oil don't sell someone a gallon of oil. Instead, what they do is have broader effects on public policy. And so one of the real significances of this book is that it points us to the power of language and communication for affecting national scale policy towards oil.
And so it doesn't affect like somebody buying an electric car and not buying oil?
No, but it's possible that could be an outcome of reading this book or reading people's discussions about rhetoric.
My only point being it may have consumer effects, just perhaps not. I guess your point is it's not direct.
Right.
But it could still have consumer effects. Like even though you're not selling a liter of oil or a gallon, you may decide not to buy as many liters and maybe not drive to a certain place or buy a more fuel-efficient vehicle.
Well, absolutely. One of the more significant essays in the collection deals with the naturalization of the oil process by comparing crude oil to peanut butter and other forms of food, the domestication of oil, making us comfortable with its existence in our everyday life, which would, by as a byproduct, make us comfortable with gas-powered lawnmowers and gas-powered automobiles.
So which chapter was that you were referring to just now?
Yes, From Pipeline to Plate, The Domestication of Oil Sands Through Visual Food Analogies by Adam Tomlinson.
That sounds really interesting. So in looking at the table of contents, I see a lot of really, really interesting titles there. Can you maybe pick out one that's your favorite child amongst all the table of contents?
Well, I have two children. I would never be able to say which one is my favorite, and that's kind of the case here too. But there is a lot of interesting stuff in here. So I'll just pick out a couple of things that I think are really cool. Now, one of them, King Coal versus Prince Petrolio, Ian Wearley. he's writing about a really similar transitional state in the 18th century as Britain moved from coal to oil. And it kind of reflects where we are today as we move from oil to alternate sources of energy. To me, it's really interesting to see that it isn't a unique experience in human history. Gretchen Bakke, in her chapter Crude Thinking, she does a lot of really interesting historical work with tracing human manpower and linking it up with the advent of electricity and power. Then she looks at the ways in which we are tending to think about alternate sources of energies as if they were oil. And we can't seem to step outside of our assumptions about how oil affects our lives in order to truly think of alternate sources of energy.
Interesting.
A third one that I found really interesting was Manuel Silva Ferrer's The Birth of a Myth, The Latin American Modern Oil Nation. I thought this was a really fascinating study of the history of Venezuela, where Silva Ferrer is looking at the ways in which the wealth from the oil fields in Venezuela basically provided the means to build the outward appearance of a modern oil nation without providing the infrastructure that would have truly educated people, allowed the poor people to raise their station. So when visitors come to the country, they see what they think is a modern nation, but then there's the slums that where people's lives do not change, do not get any better. There's no way for them to get any better. With this current civil unrest in Venezuela, it seemed to me like this was a really brave statement for Silva Ferrer to be making and really valuable for the rest of the world to learn.
I love that chapter as well. It reminds me of the value of the deep historical contributions to this collection. Penelope Plaza's contribution takes a more contemporary critical perspective on some of those same issues, which I also value. But when I talk to my students about this work, the chapter that most strikes out to me is How Not to Stop a Pipeline by Sean Zwickerman. And it particularly resonates because living in northern Minnesota, we are at the intersection of pipelines. Some of my students participated in some of the protests of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was just over in North Dakota, just next door. Very committed to the notion of protest as a way to resist this kind of change and alliance with First Nations peoples. This chapter helped me explain some of my thinking to them in many ways. I'd like to give you a passage from it if I could. Performance of generalized discontent is sometimes not an effective strategy for change. Protest gets attention and participation feels empowering, but if it resumes in its current form, the protest will continue to be but a sideshow to the actual decision-making process. And so those students of mine who stand at the intersection of Lake and Superior Street at a kind of government plaza where some of the protest work happens in Duluth, Minnesota, when they've expended that energy on protest, I invite them back into my classroom and say, okay, let's talk about the rhetorical strategies you need, not just to stand there with a sign, but to become part of the decision-making process in our community to affect the real policy change that maybe would keep people from needing to stand in that plaza in the future.
So does that mean like going to municipal meetings, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Becoming involved in the honest-to-goodness government, workings of government. Duluth is a small enough town, 80,000 people, that we have had students participate on some of the advisory committees. When students take that first step into the government process, it's, I think, perhaps the protest feels more empowering. I'm not going to deny the power of that kind of collective action, but in the long-term transformative sense, using their rhetorical skill set to help persuade city policymakers, even just to pass resolutions, it changes them. And I'm very grateful for that.
It's a deeper kind of participation. So I just want to follow up a little bit here and talk about where would you use these chapters or this entire book when you were teaching undergrads? In my experience in teaching at half a dozen universities in both Canada and the US, senior undergrads are really motivated to solve social problems or to tackle social problems, learn about them and figure out what they can do. And those students in the classes that I've worked with are very smart, very intelligent, and they can handle a text like this. It's a challenge, but it's not something that they can't get through or get over. So I wondered if you have ideas about where people might use this book in their teaching undergrads, grads, or wherever.
I regularly teach an undergraduate and a graduate level grant writing class, and I find this is the kind of text where I might give select chapters to a gifted undergraduate who expresses an interest in energy policy, for example, as an area where they'd like to become involved in making change. At the graduate level, I find I attract students in those classes who really are interested in becoming leaders in their communities. And this is the kind of books that I think shows them how corporations exercise the levers of power, how nonprofit organizations can attempt to work with or against, in some cases, those corporate energies. And finally, to be aware of exactly what the levers of power within the government are. In May 2018, I logged into the Google Drive file where you and I were writing the introduction to the book. And while we were typing, the television news came on and announced that there was a fire at the oil refinery. It's in Superior, Wisconsin, just across the harbor from where I live. The fire was releasing toxic gases that forced a 3-mile evacuation out of the middle of downtown Superior. And I think I messaged you and said, where does this pipeline go? This pipeline that ends in my hometown that's currently on fire. And I think you told me, yes, that...
Yeah, it starts in Alberta.
It starts in Alberta, the Clipper?
Yes.
And it was at that very moment, as we were writing a book about the rhetoric of oil, that I really felt the significance of what we were doing, right?
Yes.
Oil was the thing producing a cloud of toxins over my neighborhood, and the responses in the week after were just as complicated and not very helpful, right? People talking about how irresponsible it was to have this kind of danger in our community based from the oil refinery, how we needed to upgrade the technologies to have a safer kind of oil, right?
Yes.
But those aren't the answers necessarily, right? I mean, it leaves us still in the age of oil that this book so thoroughly discusses. It's hard not to feel the power of your scholarship when the thing you're writing about is on fire across the bay.
So in what ways is this book meaningful to you personally?
One of the things that grinds my gears is to hear people in energy humanities talk about oil as being a spectral substance, which you don't see it. It's invisible until the pipeline ruptures and it comes pouring out. But if you live in a place like Edmonton or Calgary or Fort McMurray, then there's nothing spectral about the oil. It's an integral part of your community and you see it. You see all the trappings of it. Of course, you don't see the crude itself gushing out all the time, but you can't miss the fact that your daily life is impacted by the production and refining of oil.
Thanks for listening. We've been talking with the editors of a book called The Rhetoric of Oil in the 21st Century, Government, Corporate, and Activist Discourses. It's part of the Routledge Series in Rhetoric and Communication and is available now. If you'd like to give me some feedback about this podcast, my email address is roger.graves@ualberta.ca. And the podcast is available at rogergraves.podomatic.com. Thanks for listening.